Well, thank you for coming this morning. This is the second edition of the talk. I gave the first round last night. We had about 175 people here, which was a great group, and a nice crowd again this morning, so much appreciated. And to begin, we'll simply do a very basic opening prayer. So for that, we can stand. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen. Hail Mary. Full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen. We adore you, O Christ, we praise you. Holy Cross, you have redeemed the world. Saint Joseph, pray for us. Lady of Sorrows, pray for us. In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen. Be seated, thanks. So welcome, and again, if you don't have notes, you want to get the notes, they're on the back table there. I will make references as I go along. I think you find it helpful because what we're going to do is walk through a lot of information. I'm going to throw a lot of things at you, okay? And you'll probably leave with the, overwhelmed. That's what I got last night from everybody. I'm like, wow, that was a lot, Father. Yeah, I know. So hang on. But anyway, so topic is gender ideology and how does one respond to it. And as we go through here, this is in different sections. So to simply open it, okay, I have some introductory disclaimers about the topic and how we're going to handle this. And they're in my opening pieces here. So first of all, I just think at the outset it's good to explain that oftentimes in our contemporary cultural mindset and the discourse about this, this is lumped together with same-sex attraction. So homosexuality, whatnot, and we have out there in the world the moniker or the label LGBTQ, et cetera. But the fact is, it's really kind of, I think, a disservice or an injustice to put those two things together. So my opening points are about the fact that we're going to try as much as we can this morning to separate out same-sex attraction on one hand and the gender conversation on the other, because they're not the same. We have to treat them different intellectually, theologically, pastorally, from a counseling perspective. They're just different animals in many respects. For all the things that are related about them, they're not the same. Okay, so that's my opening disclaimer. So, and also, terms are important, right? We're going to work on language, because especially with this topic, language is very important. So my first point here, homosexuality, that is a term that we're not always as keen on in the church's official language or pastoral practice. We prefer to use the term men and women who experience same-sex attraction. It's much more precise. It puts the emphasis on the person and not so much on some sort of a category. We don't like categorizing people because people are people. So persons who experience SSA is that. Transgenderism is also not a great term either for similar reasons. It's better described in our experience as persons, so person, who experience discordance or a dysphoria or a disharmony about their sexual identity. Right, so that's a long title. It's quicker to say transgender, but the fact is more accurately, it's a person who experiences a discordance about who they are as a male or female. So that's how we're gonna talk about this, all right? So like I said, same-sex attraction, gender discordance lumped together, but they are different, right? 99% of this talk will focus on gender discordance. That's how we're going to do the bulk of our talk this morning. Very little on SSA. The church, Catholic Church, has, and the scriptures have a very, very long, extensive body of teachings about same-sex attraction. We've been talking about it for a long, long time in the church, and we have a pastoral approach to it that's been tried and true and tested, so we have that. But when it comes to questions of gender dysphoria and ideological issues, we have, on one level, a much, much smaller body of teachings. This is, in its current way, being articulated a much newer topic for us as a church. There's really no official document out there about it. At the very end, I'll point you to one document, which is kind of sort of only about it in passing. So on the whole, our body's limited about that. Now, however, as I say here, the thing of it is, when it comes to gender questions, we're talking about what's called Christian anthropology, which is a fancy term for the right way to understand the person in light of Jesus Christ. So in other words, if I want to know myself the best and know my nature the best, I'm going to look to Jesus and Revelation to show that to me. When we think about it in those ways, then the whole gender topic we're dealing with today is often really about questions of mind-body dualism, about philosophical misunderstandings, and about bad anthropology that we have done battle with since the first days of the church. There are, the word is heresies, distortions, old heresies about this that go back to the first centuries, to the Middle Ages, to the Enlightenment. So if you get really down to it, maybe the current language is new, but the fundamental issues have been with us forever, and we've always done battle with this. So it's not new on one level. So that's a comfort, right? If we want to figure out how to handle this, we just know we have tools to deal with this. We always have, okay? What is transgenderism? I guess I should say this in the beginning. It's my second from the bottom point in that first section, okay? As an ideology, it rejects maleness and femaleness, and in some respects, it's simply a modern name for the old heresies, okay? So this talk this morning, last piece on my disclaimers, we're just going to skim the surface. It's a very, very big topic. It's a topic that's heavily steeped in clinical psychology. I'm not a clinical psychologist. I'm not a behavioral scientist, so I'm only going to be able to give you some basic points about this, much, much deeper. But maybe anyhow, what I'm going to try and do is leave you with some broad outlines of how to tackle this as it comes at you in your family or in the culture at large. All right, so that's what we're going to try and do. So those are my opening kind of disclaimers about it. So to get to the meat of all of what we're going to say, right, the presentation is in two major parts, okay, part one, part two, and I have this right here on this sheet. The first part of how to respond to gender ideology as we encounter it out there in the world, or even in our own hearts, I suppose, is a response of ideas, of concepts, of theory, of intellectual arguments, of data. So you've got this kind of heady response that one could say. It's how you argue points, how you debate points. That's one way to address it. And we have to lay that out as a foundation, because if we don't have that down, we can't get to the second part. The second part is, what's the pastoral care response to it? How do you deal with the person in front of you who's dealing with it? How do you treat them? How do you help them? So the pastoral care is rooted in proper arguments. So we need both these things together. And this is important, too, because honestly, the first part, you know, sometimes when one offers intellectual arguments, they sound kind of cold or unfeeling or just sort of mean or like cold water to the face. So, but the thing of it is, we have to use these arguments to get us to clarity about the right issues that are at stake. So we're just going to get ourselves through that, and that'll land us in the second part. That's how we're going to do this. Sound okay? If so, part one. Intellectual points response to gender ideology. So, what I do here in this first piece, all right, this will go on the second page in a bit here, just to lay out maybe some, and there's more, but I'll lay out some of the origins or the threads or strands that come together that are going to be a contributor to what's called gender ideology, right? And there's more, but this is some, or gender theory, okay? Gender theory, again, to restate, it's a school of thought that presupposes or says that male-female nature is fluid. It's a fluid reality, that it exists on this sort of, you know, spectrum or continuum, and that our classical categories of male-female are too binary, too imprecise, and they don't capture what, in fact, is the nature of personhood. So gender theory, gender ideology advances this notion, okay? So where does that come from? Lots of places. First one I would say here, I would call it losing the forest for the trees as an argument. And I say this because it's just a way to categorize it. I'm not trying to be pejorative, because this happens, I think, lots of times because folks are trying to work through a problem. So what does that mean? It means that this male-female thing is too imprecise if we're going to look at empirical scientific data alone. So in other words, next page, if one reads the books on this and on gender theory, what they simply say is that if you look at a human body closely enough, you're going to find a whole range of variations between males and females on hormonal levels, on physiology, on brain chemistry, on genital makeup, on all these different things that we think make us male and female. These people would say, no, no, the data, the science says there's a whole range, right? You know, it's how a testosterone is received, it's how estrogen is processed, and there's all these different ranges and different categories, and so they would say, the science tells us male and female are too simplistic, doesn't really exist. So if you look really, really, really close, right, so as in other words, if you look up at the trees, you're missing what I'd call the forest, because you're looking so close at the trees. If you look so close at it, you get lost in the spectrum of male and female, right? So you rely merely on biological markers, binary, either or doesn't work. And so they will go on to say, since the biological range is so broad, that male and female really are more a function of social traditions that we have constructed, and we shoehorn persons into this in a very imprecise and limited manner, in a way that they would say does damage to their person. So what the argument is that the better way to handle this is to say, let's not categorize anybody, let's just let you be what you want to be. Okay? So male and female are social conventions as opposed to a biological spectrum with infinite variations. That's one piece of the puzzle. If I had more time, I'd say more about it, because there's a lot of science and psychology behind that, but that's kind of my glancing blow at that piece of it. Another facet, I mentioned this a bit ago, mind-body dualism, and the idea in our current notion, cultural idea, that the mind is more real than the body is. Okay? So in other words, the idea that the perception of self has only a limited connection to one's actual body, that the mind is what's stronger, the mind is what's dominant, and in fact, if the mind says one thing about me, then the argument goes, I must bend my body around it because my mind is somehow supreme. This, as far as the church is concerned, we'll get to this further on, is a distortion of authentic personhood. We would say body and soul and mind are a harmonious, authentic whole, and to try and make one of those two dominant over the other is to divide the person and to misunderstand the person. So this is challenging, but it is how we often think these days, right? So my body should be subjected to the absolute authority of what the mind thinks about it. So by extension, third point there, physical and observer reality is entirely subject to whatever one mind may think about it. If a person thinks someone or something or oneself is something, then it must be the case that it is that thing. By example, if I think that I'm a giraffe, then I must be a giraffe, right? And no one may deny what my mind has constructed because my mind is supreme. And to be honest, the Supreme Court in recent decades has already constructed its decisions and arguments around this very fact, that in the mind, one has the right to construct one's version of reality, personhood, and purpose. The court has said as much. So even our own court is buying into the idea that the mind can construct reality regardless of what reality that's physical actually tells me about myself. This is a major facet of the gender ideology issue we're facing today because so much of it is about the mind saying the body is false. We have to understand it for what it is. Another piece, freedom in quotations these days demands that there are no biological boundaries to my creativity. In other words, to the average, this is a very American problem, by the way, okay? Absolute freedom requires the possibility of remaking oneself according to one's preferences, refusing to accept the limitations of what has been decided for us. In American parlance, all right, we don't like being told what to do, like ever, okay? It's just kind of like our thing. As I was in Germany a while ago, and they kept trying to understand why we did certain things here, it just confounds them. I finally said, look, I said, America will always be a frontier country. We will just always be a people who don't want to be told what to do ever, okay? It's playing itself out again these days in lots of ways, right? In our mind, freedom means I can do whatever I want. In the church's mind, freedom means no. Freedom is the possibility of choosing what's right. Those things are not the same thing. Because the right and the good and the true are one thing, freedom means I have the capacity to do those things. I'm not free when it's taken from me the chance to do what is good. The average American says, no, freedom is no limits, no boundaries, open frontier, open spaces. I can do what I want to do. That's how we think about freedom. So therefore, okay, taking this concept to its radical new levels, a truly free person is one who can change one's name, one's family, one's body, if one does not like any of those things. If I don't like it, I can just bend it, I can change it, I can modify it. It rubs me the wrong way to think that at birth, somebody else picked a name for me. I don't like my name, I'm changing my name. It rubs me these days the wrong way to think that at birth, a sex was decided for me. I don't like it, I'm changing it. So all those things are expressions of freedom run amok. That's how this is playing itself out, right? To put another way, that last point, persons view selves and others more and more as a blank canvas, and human freedom for maximum self-actualization should have no limits. Biological sex is one menu option item that I can select and construct the identity that I want to. Blank canvas, and it's going to make myself as I want, that's freedom. Another piece, what I call the elimination of guardrails. What are guardrails? So we'll explain. And technology and science have now pushed back many of the previously defined limits of what we can do to alter our bodies. Once upon a time, it was just unthinkable that we could do certain medical things, which today are kind of commonplace. So as things advance so-called further and further in the realms of medicine, science, technology, and everything else, it starts to plant the idea in my mind that I'm not bound by biological realities anymore. Okay, we just think of things as limitless. If I don't like something about my body, I can change it. If I'm sick, I can take a pill. If I have this disease, it can be cured. So we have pushed back the boundaries of mortality and what's given more and more and more and more. So I would say in the past, okay, so prior generations, on that same bullet point, had stronger socially accepted limits on what was not possible, and those guardrails kept certain behaviors in check. A guardrail, which is, if you will, a bunch of socially accepted limits that you just don't cross. Okay? Highways have them for a reason. We all know as we're going down the highways, things just go better if we stay within the lines, and the guardrails are there to keep us safe because they give you boundaries to where you can careen the automobile. All right? Same thing for behaviors. We all need guardrails, and we take it for granted that until recently there were guardrails to medicine because there's some things you just couldn't do. But now we have this idea that I can do anything in my body, pretty much anything. It takes out a whole bunch of guardrails, all right? And along with that, there are social guardrails. The next piece down, the collapse of common Western Christian social fabric that we're going through right now has eliminated a whole series of behaviors, ideas, or options that always were considered off limits or scandalous. Scandal doesn't exist today in the same way that it used to. But back then, you know, in the 40s, 50s, 60s of this country, certain things were just socially off limits. You just didn't do them. They were guardrails, and nobody questioned it because it was just accepted. If you take those things out, then we are left to try and construct them on our own. And the fact is, it's an extremely difficult burden for a person to have to try and construct all the guardrails of life. We have this idea these days, some of us, that it's good to not have guardrails. And the church would say, no. In Revelation, in the scriptures, in human nature that God has made to us, he's given us boundaries so we don't have the burden of constructing them. You don't want to go through life making up all the social rules. It's crushing for a person. It's not healthy for a person or for a culture. And we rob people of real freedom if we make statements like there should be no rules. That's bad for us, okay? So that last bullet point on page 2, commonly accepted norms surrounding sexuality, marriage, family, the gender, they acted as guardrails on behavior. So next page, this is important. They were channels that forced people to work through their internal conflicts and issues within certain limits, right? So in other words, we have always in human history had interior conflicts about ourselves. There's never been a time when we have been free of discontentments, okay? What's different about right now is that we've taken away so many of the previously accepted limits that force us to work through our conflicts in healthier manners. Now, with the limits gone, sky's the limit on all the different things we can think of to deal with our interior conflicts, many of which aren't healthy at all. Okay, but we just do them because we can. Once upon a time, it was unthinkable. So like I said, right, this is a burden on an individual to invent their own boundaries rather than having givens. And last bullet point, people may not pretend to create their own gender identity because all the guardrails or channels that previously made this socially and culturally unthinkable have been removed, right? So this is a serious problem. It's a serious piece of the puzzle, okay? Another facet, again, I'm just pulling strands here, right? There's a whole bunch more, but these are just some, and I'll get to more as we go along in the talk, too. What I call the tell-all culture right now, and it's the way that we deal with issues, and it relies upon the mass affirmation of other people for my self-worth. Okay, how does this work? It's the idea that we should let everything out and not hold anything in, and never kind of pause to ask the question, is it wise to have a filter? Is it wise to have a filter, okay? The mentality denies the individual the needed freedom to pass through what I would call the roller coaster ride of internal phases, shifting desires and questions of self that are natural and are always changing in life that happens. But instead of just kind of writing it out, I broadcast each change as I'm going through it, okay? And I do it because I'm looking for everybody else to affirm it and prop up my weak, insecure self, rather than being grounded as a son or daughter of Christ, Most High. I'm grounded in everybody else's opinion about me, which is nothing, that's no grounding at all, but I crave it. And then unfortunately, once I put myself out the three shifting phase I'm going through, I have had to put myself into labels and categories to fit into a group. And unfortunately, sometimes I have therefore locked myself into something I can't get out of, right? How hard is it for people who, quote unquote, come out when they're like, say, 14, and because they have this strong desire for a person of the same sex, and then frankly, 5-6 years later, it's probably gone because it does actually happen. Well, then what do you do now? You've kind of built this whole idea around your new group and you can't get out of it. Okay, so all of this kind of feeds into the difficulty of the gender movement and questions about gender identity, because we are in this race with self to categorize, to tell, to explain, and it does a lot of damage, right? It's a very damaging dynamic. Excuse me. And then last piece, just to put this out there, because I think it's often overlooked, but I must mention it because I just think it's part of the piece of the puzzle, right? The departure from agriculture and rural life. This is also part of our problem, right? Vast segments of the modern West, Europe, America no longer practice agriculture in order to survive. We recreationally garden. We love ecotourism. We can go to the park and look at it, and we like camping for a weekend, and we like survival games on reality TV shows about islands and everything else. But the fact is, no one is forced to live by nature right now. Very few people, okay? When that happens, all right, we have the luxury of not having to think that we're bound by the laws of the natural world, that we can just bend them at our own will, especially when it comes to reproduction and to fostering new life. So this tells us, well, reproductive laws apply to the rest of creation, but not to us. We can manipulate these forces at will. An agrarian society, a farming society, my next point down, intuitively gets male, female, reproduction, birth, death, in a manner that is lost on the suburbs and on the cities, okay, because you're not living in it. To put it very bluntly, last point, a farmer can't believe in gender ideology, he will starve. I mean, this is common sense, right? When the whole world was farming, you just knew, to put it like this, what the birds and the bees meant, because that's how you survived, okay? So the current cultural debate we're having about what gender means is a luxurious product of a leisure culture that has forgotten how to farm and take care of itself off the land, right? And so it's decadent, it's all these things, right? And again, I'm not trying to pick on people, but the fact is, when you live off the land long enough, pretty soon you begin to realize you think you're better than it, right? So this is a major part of our dilemma, more than I think we often understand. Page 4. So, gender theory ideology, the idea that male-female is a construct, that there's this wide range of options, that there's all these things. So here's some strands that feed into it. There's more, but at least this is a lot of them, all right? Next thing is, okay, if that's sort of the argument out there, and again, there's more, but I'm getting the highlights, how does the church respond to it on the intellectual plane, right? So again, we'll get to the pastoral care piece a little bit later on, but we first must get down the intellectual arguments about the topic. So to start with, we just go to Revelation itself, we go to the catechism. And I have here three catechism paragraphs that are extremely helpful for these topics, right? And you might think these days, after all the chatter about this, if you open the catechism, there's like this huge section on this. The fact is there's not a lot, because it's actually, from the church's perspective, pretty simple. And here are the three paragraphs that are probably the most relevant. First one, number 369. And these emphases, by the way, are original, I did not add these. Man and woman have been created, which is to say, willed by God. On the one hand, in perfect equality as human persons, on the other, and their respective beings as man and woman. Being man and being woman is a reality which is good and willed by God, man and woman possess innate dignity which comes to them immediately from God, their creator. Okay? What's the catechism saying? The catechism is saying that there is only male and female. That's it. And not only that, this idea of male and female is desired by God, planned by God, wanted by God. It's what he willed to weave into the fabric of the entire created order. Okay, I should say it's the dominant fabric in the created order, right? For all the exceptions that there are in nature, the fact is the fundamental driving picture of the world is male-female through all of creation, right? So the catechism says that it's a good thing. It's a desired thing. It's a purposeful thing. In other words, as we get further down, one should not fight against that. So male and female, he created them, the church says, is a black and white category. There doesn't need to be confusion about that. There is no asterisk in Genesis with all the exceptions to male and female. There's only two, okay? Section 2333, everyone, man and woman, should acknowledge and accept his sexual identity. Now that's a loaded sentence right there, but it's extremely important. We'll get to it later. One must know who one is, one must accept who one is. That is the whole burden and battle of life. There's no getting around that, all right? We'll get to this later, but the whole idea to try and change one's gender is a mistaken way to deal with this fundamental battle to understand oneself. There are better and worse ways to handle misunderstandings. Surgeries to fix gender are worse ways. Good counseling is a better way. This is what the church is going to try and get us down to, all right? Next sentence, physical, moral, and spiritual difference and complementarity are oriented toward the goods of marriage and the flourishing of family life. In other words, a complementarity means two things that go together. They fit together like parts that make up a whole. They are equals, but they are different. And the church says those differences that are both of equal dignity in creation are designed to advance marriage and the family. We don't want to tamper with the building blocks of what's fundamental to our society. That's what it's trying to say, among other things. And in section 2335, each of the two sexes is an image of the power and tenderness of God with equal dignity, though in a different way. This has been the thing from the beginning of time, right? How do men and women deal with each other? It's messy, isn't it? Right? It's been true forever. But the church has always said the best way to do this is to realize that male and female are not interchangeable. They are equally beautiful, they are different, but they each have dignity and power all on their own. All right? So at no point does it ever go well if one tries to suppress the other. That's a violation of equality and dignity and complementarity of the sexes. But this idea you can just swap them is ridiculous. Okay? That's not good. So this is about how God plans us and wants us to live, right? So that's some scriptural church revelation catechism arguments. There's a few more, but these are the kernel, if you will, of it. Because again, as we see it, this is not complicated. No? I would say, next piece down, mere biology is not enough. Natural law and teleology are also needed. This is the section that you have to get into to try and, I think, to answer the current objections that come to us in the realm of the physical and behavioral sciences. Let's say there's this whole range of gender based on hormones and physiology and brain chemistry and everything else. You know, we can say there's all these exceptions, right? If you're going to cut through that, I think the only way to do it is to appeal to what's called natural law. Natural law has to do with an appeal to arguing and reasoning that talks about, to put it very simply, the design of things, how things function for a purpose and for a reason, which means it's not explicitly scriptural. They're self-evident based on how one studies things and figures out what they're for. So the word is teleology. A telos means an end. It's for something. It's a purpose. And so there's a whole body of teaching in Catholic thought about most things sexual and, frankly, everything else, too, that has to do with the ends of things, what things are for. This sounds complicated to us, but the fact is we're really good at this because we do it all the time. We're actually, in most respects, hyper-teleological people. That's why this makes so much sense, okay? And my second point, but it explains, usually the word that we use to describe this is the word normal. Normal, in everyday parlance, refers to something's proper end, like we figured out what it's for and what it's not for, right? It's not normal to write sentences with a hose. I use a pen for that, okay? It's not normal for a car to have only two wheels, that would make it a motorcycle or a bicycle. A car normally has four. It's not normal for cars to be used for, climbing mountains, I guess, unless you watch Subaru commercials. But the point is, there are ends to things, right? So we all know it's not normal to eat roofing nails, because we know that that goes against the end of my digestive system, which is to keep me alive. If I eat roofing nails, you know what's going to happen to me. That's not normal. So we use normal all the time. We've grown fearful of normal because we're very sensitive, rightly so, to people who feel like they fall outside normal categories. So we're kind of edgy on this word right now, but the fact is normal is a good word. We shouldn't be afraid of it. We'll come back to why that's going to be okay further down in the talk there, right? Usually, normal is what's accepted and necessary for the ongoing transmission of life and the survival of the human race, though through natural as in not artificial means. Normal would mean, next point down, according to God's plan. Okay? So to tease this out a little bit more, here's the next section of points. Science identifies different bodily systems that exist for the end, the telos, of maintaining life. Respiratory, circulatory, nervous system, we have all these bodily systems, right? We've categorized ourselves, we've done this since the Greeks. Any doctor, any medical person will define normal based on this criteria. Is it making you stay alive or is it not? If it's at the service of life, the continuation of the person, of the ongoing health of the body, if that's what it's doing, then it's functioning normally toward its telos, toward its end. If my heart has some sort of an irregular rhythm to it, the doctor's going to say, well, that's not normal because it's compromising your life. So every time I go to the doctor, with one glaring exception, which I get to, we are all good at normal. And doctors are good at normal, and they're in the business of normal because they want normal. What's normal? Normal is healthy because it's good to live. The entire bodily system is constructed to make us keep living. Okay? We're good at this if we, generally we're good at this because we tend to operate more than we realize on the plane of the self as just this isolated entity, just me. However, the church says, but there's another plane that one must think about when it comes to normal and toward the advancement of life, and it's this, it's on the communal, social plane, is into the advancement of the entire species to the next generation, to the next, to human race to continue on. And that gets us into the reproductive system, okay? Next point down. Maleness and femaleness are essential to the reproductive system, of which each person has only one half, right? We don't think about that way, but I only have half reproductive system. It's not because I'm a priest, okay? It's because I'm a man. Women have the other half, right? And if one pays attention to one's body carefully, one starts to realize, I'm missing certain things for this to make any sense, all right? So reproductive system, we only have half of it, all right? It only makes sense when it's viewed as a whole. Why? Because God fashioned it that way to force people to get together. So we wouldn't be isolated and the word is monads, things that don't interact, they're just sort of our little cells that are stuck on themselves. No, God says, I want communal people, so get this, I'm going to fix them. I'm going to make them have to get together to make more of them. Okay? What a disaster, you know? But it works. Here we all are, right? So the point is, we have to think about the system to its proper telos, to its proper end, right? So my second point there, maleness and femaleness as binary categories are essential to the reproductive system. They're essential to it, okay? So if I start tampering with male and female, then I'm tampering with a healthy understanding of a system. So variations on the system that do not allow life to be created are viewed as abnormal against the end of the system. So last point on page 4, it's a major anomaly in a central bodily system to view a person as something other than male or female, or worse, to try and change them from being one sex to another. That's an attack on a healthy bodily system. In medicine, we don't do this anything else, right? You know, if I went to the doctor and said, you know, I would like my heart to become a third lung, they'd say, are you kidding? You're going to be dead. Okay? It's working. Don't mess with it, right? But when it comes to reproduction, though, we tamper with it all the time. Okay? We suppress it because children are inconvenient in our culture, right? So therefore, we're always suppressing healthy bodily systems and we're distorting how we understand what it's for. Okay, so, and this leads to the whole gender piece. So next page, page five. Second bullet point from the top. We can get away with distorted thinking when it comes to sexuality because a singleism, a person isolation, can get away with not using the reproductive system to do what it's supposed to do, reproduce in a way that's not possible for other bodily systems because I've only got one half of reproductive system. So I can play the game when it comes to this bodily system of reproduction. I can, you know, when it comes to heart, lung, brain, nervous system, if I tamper with that, I'm dead in a hurry, okay? But if I tamper with reproduction, I'm not dead right away, usually. But what dies is the next generation. Okay, so then humanity dies. I might not, but humanity does. That's where everything goes off the rails. And so we have this sort of freedom, if you will, to kind of mess with this because it's not immediately obvious that we're doing harm to ourselves by messing with reproduction the way that we always do in our culture. Which gives us this idea, back to gender, that we can just sort of muck around with this stuff and think it's okay, but it's not. So, like I say here, middle point down, such a view reveals a hyper-self-oriented viewpoint of a person, as opposed to one that views a person as part of a community, part of a system, part of a human family, rather than a merely isolated individual, right? So the whole gender movement in its worst forms, okay, that actually destroys healthy systems is in many respects respectful of a very lonely, lonely society. People who are kind of mistaken about the proper notion of community. They're looking for it. We'll get to that later. But I mean, in its worst forms, it's a lonely way to handle things, all right? So the destruction, next point down, either in concept or medical practice, the sexual difference between men and women represents the height of individualism to the destruction of the future of the human race, which is by nature communal. That's why, next point, it's not normal, because it's not the service of humanity or the future. Okay? So my proper end of my half of my system and your half of your system is not being honored if I don't understand what it's for. So this gets us down, this is going somewhere, okay? If you go back to the arguments of whether there's no male or female, the answer goes like this, next section. To respond to an above transgender theory point about the variations in biological markers that exist, okay, most of them are relevant when you come down to these basic points. A woman is defined as someone who can receive the male in the sexual act and or conceive a child to naturally grow inside of her until birth. That's a woman. It's not more complicated than that. A man, same thing, pretty easy. Defined as someone who can engage in a sexual act with a woman and can impregnate her. Okay? If we use those two things as an operating definition, then we're back on the forest and not the trees, which is the confusing part, right? So without getting into hormonal variations, physiological variations, everything else, all you have to say is, can they have sex? Can they get pregnant? That's really how you define male and female, right? Don't get into the weeds, okay? Now, note, even unintentionally infertile couples can still engage in a sexual act with each other to want to create life, even if their bodies won't let them. So this doesn't crash the argument. So the sexual act itself defines male-female, even for infertile couples. And then also, because it comes to bear, on it's a counter-argument, if one is sterilized, okay, and one renders themselves infertile with contraception and whatnot, that's just a misunderstanding of the natural end of the body that also doesn't destroy the argument of what makes male or female. That's just a misuse of the reproductive system. Okay. So using the above criteria, what's normal in telos is the markers of sexual identity, as we've done so until recent years. This is a key point. The number of authentically non-male or female non-binary persons is extremely, extremely rare. So all of a sudden we got this idea that it's like all these people who aren't in categories, just not true. Okay, I mean that's amazing. All of a sudden all these people aren't male or female? No. Okay. If the things I'm listing here are the driving criteria, which they must be based on teleology, based on how we treat every other system of our body, if I think about reproduction like I think about my lungs, which is the only logical way to do it, then I'm left with male-female is about reproduction. If that's the criteria, then the exceptions to that, as in a person's a non-binary, 0.01% of the population, max. Very, very, very rare. Very, very rare. Last piece. It's essential that one understands maleness and femaleness relative to their complementarity and related roles in the creation of new life. So if we understand what our sexuality and selves are for, we don't get lost in the argument. Unfortunately, as a culture, and I'm not trying to condemn anybody here because we all make personal choices and I get that, but the thing of it is we have been so out of whack for so long on reproduction and sexuality that it has led to this gender problem that we're dealing with right now. It's a major piece of it because we haven't gotten it right as a culture. Okay? And now we have to figure it out. We are reaping what we did not sow, if I can put it that way. Okay? So, there is that. Now again, normal, well, I'll say more about it below because I know it's a tricky thing to say normal these days, but it's necessary and it's okay. We'll get to why it is later. This section right here on spiritual necessity of these categories, okay, I'll go over this fast because in the interest of time, but this is worth noting. So, male and female is in the catechism, it's in the scriptures. Male and female is in the teleology, the ends of our persons. Male and female is also stamped in our spiritual identity. This is a spiritual category. So, the Lord wants us to understand why this is really important. If you look at the scriptures from the very beginning, Genesis, all the way to the end of Revelation, there is a consistent strand that runs through the entire thing that speaks about how God relates to us with spousal imagery, male, female, as in God is the bridegroom and we are the bride. He has married us. He's married the people of Israel as his cherished, beautiful spouse. And we speak about the church as the bride of Christ. He is the groom who has married us, the bride. And if you look at the mystics, the saints, our spiritual writers, so many of them talk about their union with God in spousal terms. And it's not just because that's all that they knew, because they weren't enlightened on gender. It's because they're tapping into what they know is fundamental to our nature, because God created it that way. In other words, God is a union of different persons, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, who fit together as a beautiful whole. They're complements, all right? And he made us to relate to him in a same way. We are to relate to God as a union of differences. A union of differences. Male and female image, the marriage images us to God in the same way. Men and women are a union of differences, but they're complements. That becomes an image of the spiritual life because me and God are different. And we're supposed to become unified in a beautiful communion of life and love. I don't want to have it in my head that me and God are the same. That I'm a union of saints, that would be an absolute total disaster, okay? So, what am I trying to say here? To erase as a culture and as a society the essential difference of male and female and also their authentic union is erasing a fundamental core spiritual understanding of how we and God connect, okay? So you don't want to do that. It's not like it's meaningless to get rid of gender. Doing so erases the fundamental image that God uses to speak to us and relate to us. And you never, ever want to do that. Bad, bad, bad. Okay? So we had to hang on to this very, very carefully, right? My last bullet point, page 6 now, on that section up there on the top section. Male and female exist in creation as an essential pointer to our need and ability to enter into a spiritual spousal union with God. Okay? I must take God as my spouse. He's other than me. He's different than me. He's not the same as me. And so I need to make sure I understand this in my bones, right? So this all gets us down now. Then we're almost done. We'll take a little break, okay? I promise I'll stop for a second. You can breathe, and I can breathe. Discordance. This is the next heading, all right? So this is a sequential argument I'm making for you here. It goes like this. If male and female is a given, if that's the reality, if I can justify that on catechism, scripture, natural law, and spiritual theology, which I just got done doing, so that's male and female, then the next thing that happens is that if there is a experience that puts me outside of male and female, the answer isn't to say, you're right. The answer is to say, there's a discordance. You're out of accord with the proper understanding of reality. In other words, if there are guardrails, if there are boundaries, if there are givens, to question the givens isn't to be correct, it's to be mistaken. And to tell a person, you must work through the discordance. You understand what I'm trying to say? So you can only talk about sexual identity discords, which is actually a clinical diagnosis of a problem, if one first understands that there's a right and a wrong, right? So here's the argument, I just laid it out. If church teaching about the integralism, the essential identity male and female, is the guide for what's true about our nature, then in the face of gender theory and notions that identity is fluid, we maintain there is such a thing as sexual identity discordance. This is a clinical term, all right? Discordance about sexual ID is a condition in which a person does not acknowledge his or her God-given sexual identity as male or female. There is mental confusion about one's lived experience of one's biological sex, a discord, a disharmony between what the body makes plain, what the mind should accept and understand. My body shows me things about myself that my mind must be in harmony with and must come to understanding with, right? And again, when I think body, don't just get all lost in the variations on hormones, because we all have those things. I'm talking about male-female on the reproductive end of the spectrum, right? So I must make peace with that, so to speak, okay? Another word for this, next point down, is a dysphoria. This is a psychologically persistent denial of an evident bodily reality. These things exist all the time. Here's a very common one, next point down, anorexia. That's an example of a dysphoria or a discordance. And it's very common. We probably all dealt with it in different ways. What that means is that in the mind, one believes oneself to be extraordinarily overweight, even though to all external appearances, you're not overweight, you're actually wasting away. But the mind doesn't see what the body makes plain. I'll say it again, the mind doesn't see what the body makes plain. So when a person who's anorexic says to somebody, oh my gosh, I'm really fat, your response is, oh no, you're not, okay? And it isn't to say, you're right, keep starving yourself. It's to say, you need to go talk to a counselor to work through whatever is going on in your mind that dysphoria is a part of. There's something wrong with how you see yourself. That's how you handle dysphorias. That's how you handle the dysphorias. Apparently, I didn't know this, there's studies on this, it's common for men to think their noses are too big. Did you know that, men? And you wouldn't believe this, but men go to doctors saying, I want you to cut off part of my nose. And the doctors have to say, no, your nose is fine, it's working, it's a healthy bodily system, I'm not gonna do that to you. Go back and think about where your nose is fine. Okay, so it happens with arms, this happens like all the time. The gender thing is just another variation on it. Yet for some reason on this one, we're like way off the reservation on this. Okay, get to why that is in a second, all right? So one must understand it for what it is. It's a mental battle, okay? So if one accepts that there's a norm, then one can diagnose the discordance and can help a person authentically, okay? With that, we are 45 minutes in, so we'll take a little break. We're halfway through. So stand up a little bit, stretch yourselves, and then we'll come back a couple minutes and finish out the rest of the talk. So that was part one. And again, the idea behind part one is, you know, we have to lay out as best we can the some of the, there's more, you know, intellectual arguments that respond to the disinformation around us in the culture. So we do that as best we possibly can. Part two, therefore, is, okay, based on those arguments, how does one authentically respond to people right in front of you who are dealing with this issue, okay, the pastoral care piece of it? Now here, again, there's way more about this than I'm actually gonna get into. So this is a huge, huge topic, so I'm just gonna give you a couple of pieces, and you have to do more on your own to research and read about it, but I'll give you some outlines anyhow, if nothing else. So we'll call this part pastoral and spiritual care in response to gender ideology and discordance. So I would say that first bullet heading there is important. Authentic pastoral care begins with accepting some fundamental non-negotiable points that at first seem to be contradictory, all right? I'm gonna give you two points, which at first glance might seem they don't go together, but the fact is they're essential to hold them in tension. Okay, the first point goes like this. One must accept male and female, all right? Those are given categories. So the church maintains that the only pastoral remedy for gender identity conflicts is discordance, is to learn to accept one's place in God's plan as male or female. Males and females each love and share and build the world in a different and complementary way. It is part of God's plan, right? So like I said last time in the talk, I mean, just imagine what the world would be like if it were all males. What a horrible reality. For sure, they say. Just imagine if it were all females. What a disaster. Yeah. So, like it or not, we need each other. Okay, so God did this for a reason, because he's just that way, you know. So we had to say, listen, you know, there will be no authentic medical or pastoral remedy that denies male and female. Any clinical approach, any medical approach, any approach that denies male and female is going to fail no matter what. It's not going to work. So any counselor, any doctor who doesn't start with the premise that there's male and female, it will fail. It will fail, okay? And if anybody tries to think that male and female are somehow not equally important in the world, they're going to fail too, right? We need each other like we are. So one's only going to achieve interior peace, joy, freedom when one accepts the non-negotiable biological, social, and spiritual guardrails or limits of the reality of male and female, all right? If one fights these fundamental truths, one will be, without exception, miserable. One's going to be miserable. This is baseline pastoral care and medicine, okay? So one must accept the categories, fundamental. However, next page, point two. Male and female does allow for fluidity, but to a degree, okay? Not total, all right? You have to understand this, all right? So yes, there's male and female, but there is a range in it, there really is. And so, and here's where you have to throw a bone to the gender theorist people. It's a fact, gender roles are constructed in many respects. There is a degree of construction that goes into them by culture, by era, by time period, and it's always shifting, so one must acknowledge that that's a fact, all right? So, I say it here, different cultures and different eras do operate on a range of constructs that help a person make sense of or fit into male or female. We tend to call those things stereotypes. We all have them, okay? Here's the thing, okay, next point down. A healthy culture, healthy family, healthy person allows for some degree of variety in stereotypes and resists defining them too rigidly. For example, it would be unhealthy, too rigid to say a woman should never wear pants or never play with trucks. That's just too rigid. It's not necessary. Or, same thing, that a man should never be a nurse, right? Well, that doesn't make any sense, okay? Now, as time passes, this is going to shift a bit as the culture understands certain things, okay? So there is some fluidity. But here's the caveat, and here's where the gender people kind of unfortunately take this too far and make a mess of it all. Next point, however, all cultures do hold a certain limits on the blurring of stereotypes of gender for a very important reason. The stereotypes about dress, appearance, duties, roles, etc. are at the service of the generativity of new offspring. In other words, they'll make people attractive. That's what makes you mate, okay? So you can only push the boundaries so far before things start to fall apart and you start attacking what's fundamental, all right? So one could say there's a range in the stereotypes of male and female, but you can't say there's no such thing as male or female. That's too far. That doesn't work because that attacks biology, reproduction, everything else. But you can say some things are more attractive than others. And cultures figure this out on their own. You don't really have to legislate this by and large. You just kind of navigate it. And as time passes, you know, I mean, certain things are attractive, certain things just aren't. And you kind of figure it out, right? So cultures protect stereotypes because, realize it or not, that's what protects reproduction. It reproducts the creation of the next generation. Okay, so the human race persists because cultures maintain limits on what is and is not attractive. Therefore, it'd be unwise to be too permissive about stereotypes of male and female. There are limits, all right, to what you can monkey with, okay? So the last two points I think are critical, the italicized ones. Proper pastoral care, a gender confusion, is gonna hold these two above points in careful tension, it's gonna be effective, right? You can't lean too far in one direction or the other. Christianity is always about the balance of the middle. Same thing, right? There's male and female, no doubt. There must be male and female. Is there a range of how you handle it? Yes, you must accept that, right? So next point critical, the goal is to help a person recognize that they fit into a category of male or female, that's the non-negotiable point, while acknowledging that sometimes it's a clumsy fit because each person is unique. Okay, the fit's going to be clumsy sometimes, right? And we've all dealt with this, right? Isn't adolescence like the worst time ever? Okay? Aren't you glad you're through it, most of you? Okay, right? It's like, gosh, who wants to go back to that? Because it's all about navigating this problem. Okay, but where do I fit? Where do I belong? I don't like this notion of femaleness in the culture, or I don't like how a man's supposed to be, or what's being presented to me on TV or social media, so I'm going to wrestle with it. We all do. But the answer to the wrestling is not to say there must not be male and female. That's a complete falsehood. And it's not a good remedy to the solution, or to the problem, right? So there have to be other ways to work through it. Other ways to work through it, okay? And one must acknowledge that very important fact. So, how does one do this? This is hard. And here I'm only going to give you a couple of little pieces, right? There's way more to this. So do not accuse me when this is over with of missing all this stuff, because there's just a lot to cover here. I'll give you a little couple pieces. So some further points of pastoral care. First of all, the gender battle is primarily a mental one before it's a biological one. Okay, one must understand that. I mean, you can get caught up on hormones and everything else, but the fact is that is so exceptionally rare. 99% of the time, if there's some gender issue, it's a mental challenge for somebody, right? It's in the mind, okay? So, we'd say some more points to consider. A good data on persons who present rapid onset gender dysphoria, ROGD for short, is slow to emerge because so much of it is agenda driven. We just had to, it's true right now, genders drive a lot of this, so we had to be careful. But we do know in some data, okay, that a very high percentage of persons with ROGD are on the autism spectrum and or suffer from ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, okay? Now be careful, that doesn't mean if you're autistic, you have a gender problem. It's the reverse. It's pretty much everybody with gender issues, almost all of them have something of these issues going on in their life. So they are somehow connected, all right? So you understand what I'm trying to say? Just because you're autistic doesn't mean you're going to have a gender issue, but if you have a gender issue, you're probably going to be either autistic or ADHD or something else is going to be just a little bit off in how you process reality and self. It's very, very common. Not airtight, there's exceptions to this. So I mention it because what people often lament who deal with this from an authentic perspective is that usually when a gender clinic gets involved with some gender things, they go right past these other issues and never treat them. And a good counselor would tell you if you just treat the root causes, it would take care of the gender thing as time passes. You don't have to get stuck on the gender part of it. Just work on the other things, and it tends to work the rest of it out with some patience and some time and some real long perseverance, okay? So one must know this, okay? But there's no medical test for ROGD. You can't, like, you know, pop out some sort of a paper that says, oh, here, you've got ROGD. It's something you just kind of figure out as one understands what's going on. If a child presents symptoms of rapid onset gender dysphoria, ROGD, and parents patiently but firmly hold the boundary and maintain their child is not some other sex, nearly all children outgrow this issue by the end of their teens. Okay? Because this happens all the time, to be honest. Before, like this became a thing over the last like 5 years. Before that, you who are parents, you just dealt with this and went, this is not a big deal. Okay? This is happening for a long, long time. So most kids grow out of it. Conversely, if parents take the route of admitting their child to a quote-unquote gender clinic, which is usually what now schools make parents do when the kid says something about it, then the child rarely ever grows out of it because they get on the gender track and then they're hooked into that system for a long, long time to come, okay? So don't do that, is what I'm trying to say. So currently, if gender is mentioned to a counselor in a first visit, they're gonna grab onto that and make that the issue. More helpful is the approach of not initially really making a big deal out of it and trying to treat the other things going on in the situation first. As best you can, it's all connected for sure, but I mean, the core stuff is what needs to be worked on as much as possible. Next page, page 8. This heading is important, okay, because we have to understand this. I call it the search for acceptance. Gender discordance is responded to differently depending upon the age of the person in question, right? So people who talk about how to handle this are gonna say to you, it's gonna depend upon how old the person is. This will vary widely depending upon the age. So for the youngest of children, you handle it one way. Questions are spoken, assumptions that they're actually not their biological sex are best handled by gently making light of them and reminding them that it's not true, right? So So, you know, son or daughter, age 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, says, you know, I think I might be a girl instead of a boy. And you say, no, that's not true. Have a cookie. We're going out to play. Go play. I mean, you just go on. You just go on, okay? And so, I mean, it's just what you do. You don't have to land on it, okay? Parents today, God love them, and I understand why, have this idea that if I don't jump on things like right away, they're scarred for life, so you panic, and it becomes this whole way to handle things that makes everything worse, okay? So the younger they are, the more you can kind of go, eh, don't worry about it. But as they get older, though, one must take seriously the comments, because what's going on is they're articulating things that they need to talk through with somebody, either you or somebody else, and we must pay attention to those things. So for teens into adulthood, one must attempt to understand what's going on behind the questions and let them articulate it in as non-judgmental a way as we can possibly handle. So if you're getting through puberty and beyond, it's about a search for acceptance, meaning the proper fit into the society stereotypes about sex. That's usually what's going on. So if they're having an issue in their teens and whatnot, then what's bubbling up is this internal thing about, I don't like these roles, I don't know where I fit, I don't feel comfortable in this image that society wants me to fit into. Those things should be taken seriously, okay? Now, there are boundaries, okay? No one is, you can't go, oh, you should become a woman. That is not what we do, because that's a bright red line we don't cross. But that aside, okay, everybody's got to have freedom to work through what's uncomfortable about becoming a man or a woman. It's a process, isn't it, okay? And people need to have freedom to be able to do that. So calmly, patiently, get freedom to tell their story, talk about why you feel that way, you know, why is that, honey, you know, and give them the room to talk it all out. And eventually, with enough patience and time, it'll work itself out, okay? But it might be messy along the way, but it'll be okay. So these last two pieces on that section, struggles about how one fits into male or female roles have been with us since the fall from Eden. We've always struggled. Okay, but the next piece, what's new is that now we've removed all the accepted guardrails that used to force us to deal with these struggles in less destructive ways, right? That's the new wrinkle in the situation. We've always had problems with gender. It's just that it's only been recently we've gotten this crazy idea that we can change it, all right? That's the problem. So you say to people, listen, you can't change it, but there's things we can do besides that to help you out, all right? We're gonna figure it out. We're gonna figure it out together, okay? That's the mentality that we're gonna have to understand, okay? So, well, we'll take comments at the end, thank you. The lure of group identity and what is cool about claiming to be a different gender, now, one must understand this, okay? And I don't want to suggest that people are fools, but just things go in trends. Gender confusion is described as a social contagion by the people who deal with this. For those approaching or moving through puberty, there is intense social pressure to attain self-acceptance as well as peer acceptance. We know this. Claiming to be another gender has become a pathway to cool or even hero status now in today's culture. So one has to understand that in some cases, not all, that's what's going on in these situations, and one must watch out for that. And in this way, gender discordance spreads among social groups like a fad. Okay, it's like a trend. Is that all that's driving it? No. Is that a factor in it? Absolutely. One has to point it out. And one way you can tell is that all of a sudden, the last couple of years, we've had this massive explosion in gender dysphoria patients. It's like, well, where did this come from all of a sudden? Is it in the water? I mean, is it in, you know, what on earth, okay? The only way you can explain it is about the fact that there must be a copycat effect going on in the hallways of high schools and across social media everywhere, right? Parents and teachers are wise to recognize it for what it is. You just have to be aware of that dynamic. Now here, this is a little trickier, but I think it's helpful. Parallels between transgender ideology and cult behavior, okay? Not every case is this extreme, but this is important to know. In my hand is a book by Maria Keffler, and you can see this on the back table when you leave, but don't take it because it's my copy. But and the reference for this is on the last page of my handouts, the Amazon reference for this. So, but anyway, the book is called Desist, Detrans, and Detox, Getting Your Child Out of the Gender Cult. And she went through this with her own kids. I think one child. And she put together a book on what she learned from the entire experiences. And what she essentially does is she draws, I think, helpful, even if not always exact parallels between cult-like behaviors in the world generically and how gender groups and the ideology can become cult-like in its manifestations. And she does it because she's saying to parents, if you understand it for what it is, you can combat it more effectively. You have to know what you're dealing with. So she lays this out. Okay, so there's a militant dynamic that overtakes persons who decide to deny their gender and often sets up loved ones for a for me or against me kind of mentality, which is very, very hard to deal with. It breaks parents' hearts. I mentioned at the start of the talk that there is a real distinction between same-sex attraction and the gender conversation. However, in this realm, there is a parallel. When you're the parent of a child who comes out as gay, and the parent of one who comes out as transgender, your experiences are very similar. Okay, so the parents deal with this in similar ways. I've dealt with both of them now, and the commonalities are striking. And they have all kind of said what this book has said. It's this me versus you militant force that starts to emerge in a household that's very, very hard. So she lays out, okay, according to Keffler, all right, this mindset that one must understand. It's about mind control. So how do cults work? In general, they identify potential new recruits, okay? And so she'd say on the gender front, so when it comes to people who are often pulled into this, it's people on the margins, people with low self-esteem, people who are social victims. You're not gonna be the popular kid in high school, you're not the popular one on the playground, you're not the popular one in the electronic virtual universe, so on the margins, right? That's where cults pick up adherents. If you want to insert gang for cult, it's the same idea. It's how inner cities run. They run in a tribal gang mentality because it's for safety, protection, and identity. That's how you do it. Same thing. If I'm on the margins and I'm vulnerable, I'm very susceptible to the gender cult kind of lure that gives me a sense of security and safety in its confines. What's the next point? Just you draw the recruit in. There's a well-rehearsed rhetoric about gender fluidity and the promise of happiness by breaking out of accepted stereotypes. They're going to say, you want to be happy? Break out of male and female. Okay, that's going to be the secret to mending what's messed up in your sad soul. So they sell this as something of a pathway. Next page. Love bomb the new recruit. Shower the new members with adoration, praise, affection, protection. So once you get in and you say, you know what, I'm actually transitioning, you get all these accolades, right, on social media, you know, among your peer group. I mean, the group just brings you in with all this affection, and it gives you all the affirmation you were seeking. Because frankly, we all want affirmation. We want community, makes total sense, and they get it from their peers. But it comes at a price, as she lays out. She says, sell, sell, sell. So you're gonna promote this new ideology from the housetops. So literally rainbow flags on the housetops, social media, we're gonna promote this everywhere. That's how cults maintain their identity. You apply hard love. In other words, you say, okay, if you want to stay in this group, you must have certain ways and think in certain ways. So you're going to conform. You're going to start changing your outfits. You're going to start using different pronouns. You're going to start doing these things. If you don't, you're out of the group. Okay? Require the renunciation of loved ones. If you agree with the cult, you are good. If you don't, you are bad, and you're to be cut off. You are to guilt and shame those who don't agree with you. You are to call them haters. Okay? If your parents, you've dealt with this now, if your kid's going through this, you know exactly what this feels like. It's a nightmare, right? You introduce and you coerce acceptance of core beliefs. So that's what love is love means, be who you are. We have these on t-shirts everywhere now. It's just, you're just reinforcing the creed of the cult, okay? And you permit zero tolerance of any criticism and zero tolerance of independent thinking. So in other words, if you go against me, we cancel you. So as Maria lays these things out, Maria Keffler, I mean, some of it doesn't exactly apply. It might seem a smidge extreme, but I got to tell you, the parallels are pretty good in a lot of these situations, okay? And she's trying to say, once your child gets hooked into this, like any other cult, it's really, really hard to get out of it. I have, over the years, dealt with people who have left, like, legit cults, and it takes them years of working through the mental mechanics of what was done to them in the experience, okay? It's very, very difficult. This is the same thing, right? People who are detransitioning, as in people who have just made the decision to stop changing their gender, I work with them, have dealt with them, have tried to be with them. It's a really, really difficult mental battle to get themselves out of an old way of thinking about it, right? So this is hard stuff. So one must understand the cult-like nature of this if one's going to keep a loved one out of it and rescue them from it, okay? Once they're in, the odds about growing out are much, much smaller. So she gives you tips in the book for how to deal with it. Mainly from a teenage perspective, she gives disclaimers about other age groups, and it's just helpful. Another section, and we're almost done. The heading here is pronouns, hormones, surgeries, pursuing the mirage of happiness. And so one has to understand this too. So the younger the child or the person, the more firmly one can resist at the outset any attempts to play into the directions of changing names, pronouns, cross-dressing, etc. If you're younger, you can be a little more forceful about just shutting that down if it doesn't seem to make any sense, all right? Remember what I said about allowing some freedom to grow? We need to have some flexibility, sure, but there are limits, and parents, you kind of know what they are, okay? If they're younger, shut it down. But the older person goes, right, the more complex, because you have to establish firm boundaries that you're not going to cross as a parent or a friend into the realm of make-believe as one deals with a loved one who has rapid onset gender dysphoria. This is very, very tricky. Because what's going to happen is they're going to want you to change pronouns or do this or that, and you got to say, okay, how far am I going to go to indulge this? And it's an extremely difficult thing to figure out where you land on the line, right? And even the experts in this, who I've worked with in the last, you know, few months and years on this, they don't agree on this entirely about the best way to handle this kind of stuff. So Maria will say in her book, Maria Koeffler, there's suggestions how to navigate this, especially with teens. And she'll say, you got to kind of figure out where your boundaries are going to be, and you got to stick to them. And it's going to be a little different for each parent, right? But there are bright red line boundaries, though, that should never be crossed, and they have to do with hormones or anything biologically modified. That is where she says you cannot go there. That is just bad, unethical medicine. Okay, it is never going to help. It destroys people. It plays into something that is very, very dangerous. So then we'll go on to say, even gestures that seem smaller, like changing pronouns or names to accommodate what they want, those are a slippery slope. And one must understand what's been called by some of us in the industry on this, the mirage dynamic of rapid onset gender dysphoria behaviors. And by that, we mean this. A person who experiences gender discordance is sold the idea that they just begin to adopt the behaviors and the identity of the other sex, then they're going to be happy. Okay, so the idea is, okay, if you just start changing these things, then you're going to find your peace. Then you're going to find your sense of acceptance. So the problem, though, is that they'll start small, and we find this over and over again in pastoral care. It's never enough. They keep doing more, 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 unless someone kind of gives them some reason to change course, right? So if they're unchecked, they just keep reaching for the next step, thinking it's going to fix it from their mental struggle of acceptance, which we all have these struggles, so we're not diminishing anybody here. So names move to pronouns, which move to hair, which move to makeup, which move to outfits, which go to hormones, which go to surgeries, because they're chasing a mirage. Every time you think you've arrived at it, it's further out from you. And you go further, and it's further out. And then when you think you finally got there, it disappears, because you realize once you've fully transitioned, you're not any happier. You're not any happier, right? It may seem like it for a little while, but we have seen this over and over again, okay? The suicide rate among people who do this, sky high, okay? The rate of particular depression, substance abuse, sky high, and it's not because they're not accepted, okay? That's what you're going to hear from the lobby on this topic, but the fact is it's purely a function of the fact that internally they just can't figure this out, right? It's just a tough nut to crack, and they're pursuing a pathway, like we said before, that denies their basic nature, and whenever you do that, it's going to make you unhappy as a person. So we just have to understand that. Next page. And there's more, but like I said, you know, in the interest of time, you can do your reading on some of this stuff too. Important to resist the temptation to demonize, and I think that more and more this is becoming a challenge because, you know, in the church we're starting to realize that we're facing a problem here, and it's tempting to paint our opponents with some sort of devil kind of brush, and you don't want to do that, okay? So when dealing with this on a personal level with a loved one or out in the culture, be careful. There's no question the devil is behind a lot of what we're dealing with. I believe that. And there's no question that deliberate agendas are at work in this. Yep. However, classic Christian practice and thought is to assume the best of intentions of one's opponents until proven otherwise and to pray for them. Okay? So one, it does no one any good to go accusing people of things that one doesn't know to be true. For many people experiencing gender discordance, they are trying to work through an internal struggle and they've been sold a false idea, okay? So it's not like it's their fault on one level, right? I mean, they've been given this idea it's gonna help them and no one has told them that they're wrong, all right? So when one understands that, one can't get mad, one has to be patient and compassionate and just let them talk it out, okay? Same thing, I think, for many therapists and politicians and quote-unquote helpers who are advancing this stuff these days, I think, by and large, they are mistakenly thinking they're being helpful, okay? I mean, I really think they actually think that they're trying to, this is, in their mind, it's compassionate, okay? It's been decoupled from what's true about reality, but nonetheless, I think they're trying to be helpful. And they are panicking. If you're a parent and this happens, you start to panic. You have a child threatening you, I'm gonna kill myself, I'm gonna do these things, so you panic, and you set aside sound reason, and you do whatever you can to try and keep them safe. So panicking people do not think clearly, and in the absence of a Christian culture with guardrails, since that's gone now, we start making up any solution we can think of, especially the seductive delusion of freedom from age-old ideas, to try and fix it. So I would say patience, calm understanding, and clear thinking are what's needed to counter what we're facing right now. Not demonizing, but patience and clear thinking, right? In as gentle a way as we can possibly do it, because we're dealing with people's fragile souls. My soul's fragile, so is yours, let's be honest, right? Some last points, and then we will be done, I promise. We'll make it all the way to the end, and we're gonna make it, okay? We have to recognize here the violence that's being done to human dignity all around us in different ways. Okay, so it does violence to human dignity to or the person who willingly mutilated body in order to attempt to change its biological sex, right? One must just understand that, okay? If I were to go to a doctor who is bona fide, he or she, and I said to them, you know, I would like you, if, well, first of all, I said to the doctor, pointing at my arm, this is a leg. They're gonna say, no, it's not, that's an arm, okay? We can see what it is. So in the same way, okay, doctors must work within reality if we're gonna protect dignity. If I go to a doctor and I want my organs, my sexual organs changed, the doctor ought to say there's nothing wrong with them, okay? And on top of that, all right, so again, same idea. If I went and said, you know, operate on my heart, they're gonna say, well, why? Well, it's not working. Well, look, it's working to me. There's an EKG, here's this, here's that. There's nothing wrong with your heart, all right? So good medicine understands that human dignity is protected in its ethics, okay? So same idea, right? It's, we do violence to dignity by trying to change our sex, right? That has to be understood. Those surgeries are irreversible in most respects. They do permanent harm, and people often end up regretting them for years and years and years to come, okay? And I think that one day, there's never gonna be a remedy to this, to be perfectly honest. It's gonna be the lawsuits that are gonna start coming from the people who went through this and realized it didn't do anything, and they start suing the medical profession for why didn't you tell me what's gonna happen, right? We're not there yet, but it's gonna come. It does violence to persons who experience mental confusion over their identity, sexual identity, to deny them the right to helpful counseling that can relieve them of this challenge because authority figures have wrongly reinforced the idea that a person might be the wrong sex, right? That does violence to dignity. Okay? So if a seven-year-old comes to you in your office or a counselor, you know, and I say, I might be the wrong sex, and you affirm that, you're doing violence to their dignity, okay? There are limits. You could say, well, you know, maybe you got questions about what it means to be a man, we could talk about that, but this idea that you're trapped in the wrong body, no, 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 okay? It does violence, next point down, to females to advance the claim that a man born a man can now be a woman. Doing so denies women their proper mode of self-expression and unique social roles in the world that men do not belong in. And the converse is true, doing violence to men in that reversal of roles too. So men, women, we have spent how many decades now trying to work on social advances in your proper mode of rights in society as unique God-given creatures, not under men's thumbs and hands, developing medicine uniquely for your bodies, and now all of a sudden that's all out the window. This is an attack on your place in society, okay? So the idea now, and you see this now more and more in commercials and social media, that like men can nurse, we call it chest feeding, That's an attack on your motherhood, right? So do not stand for that. It's ridiculous, okay? As I said last night, men can mop the floor for you, but they're not going to nurse your kids for you. There's a line, all right? So if you're born a male and you decide you're going to compete in women's sports because you've transitioned, that's a sham, and it does violence to women's rights. Same thing is reversed, right? You know, I'm born a woman, I become a man. It does violence to the unique zone of men in society that belongs to us, too. We are complementary creatures. And blurring these things as though we're interchangeable is absolutely destructive to the human condition. We have all, I understand the struggle, right? I mean, we get, people have a hard time navigating stereotypes. Of course, that's always been our problem. But to somehow suggest that we can eliminate that by changing genders, that is destructive. Okay, that's too far, right? And we often forget this last bullet point, but this has to be thought about. It does violence to our fundamental right to the truth of reality to advance the claim that a man is actually a woman and vice versa. We have the right to acknowledge the truth of reality around us. I have the right to call something what it is, because reality is reality. I have a right to reality. How about that? And if I have a person who proposes to me that I'm supposed to go along with what's not real, it does violence to my sense of truth, violence to my sense of self, violence to my sense of the world. We are made to process reality as it is. And if a person makes me live in a make-believe universe because I'm changing pronouns and images and everything else, it does violence to my sense of reality. It violates my dignity to go along with that. Okay? So one must understand that, right? There's flawed psychology going on all around this. Okay? Another piece that goes back to normal, right? I said a little while ago that we're afraid of normal these days and that there's such a thing as abnormal. So in the world, we'd say that the normal pattern of creation is that males and females get together and they create children. We'd say, therefore, it's abnormal in the pattern of the world for two men to try and have children or for two women to try and have children. That's an abnormality. Same-sex attraction is, to say it, an abnormality in the pattern of existence, right? The idea that a person could experience such profound confusion about one's gender identity, that's an abnormality in existence. So one has to hang on to normal and also hang on to abnormal if one's going to effectively help people. But here's the thing, okay, and I'm sure if I said this as clear last night in my talk, I'll try it more this morning, right? The only way we're going to actually get through that as a church and as a culture and as people is to discover the cross in that. We have not been good, I think, in recent decades as a church about preaching the cross, about the role of suffering, about the meaning of dealing with challenges and how new life comes from those things. We don't often talk about the crosses of life as life-giving and good things. We don't often talk about what it means to live with discontentments and not try and perfect everything around us. I have a huge problem with this. You know this about me. Okay, I'm a perfectionist, right? But there is a cross to be embraced with all sorts of stuff. So the only real way to pastorally help people who are in an abnormal sort of state or mold isn't to just say abnormal, leave it at that. It's to also say, and by the way, if you feel the interior pressure of abnormal and that's crushing to you, you need to find yourself at the foot of the cross with Jesus, who was rejected, maligned, didn't fit into categories. We have to lead people, ourselves, everybody, to the foot of the cross with our abnormalities. And we all have them. If you don't have that, I would say there's no way forward. There's no way out of it. It's just going to be a curse. It's just going to be a bad category. It's just going to be a weight. It's just going to be a burden. It's going to be rejection. I have found in my work of the years with the men and women who have same-sex attraction that they have a very, very, very strong devotion to the cross, to Our Lady of Sorrows, because they see in the suffering Jesus a real companion for their internal struggles. And they have found not a cure for everything, but at least a companion in the difficulty. They have found in the cross a zone, a sphere, a place where they can relate to somebody. They relate to the suffering Jesus very, very well. And it gets them through, because it's not easy. It's very hard. Same thing for gender issues, right? If we're having a hard time with stereotypes, accepting self, self-image, then without finding Jesus in the cross, we're going to have a really hard time getting out of that. He is our companion. He is our friend. He is how we handle burdens. He and the cross is what moves us through. and helps us understand that the acceptance of crosses rather than fighting against them is what brings life and peace and interior freedom. Without that, no getting out. No getting out. So as a church, we can't just have intellectual arguments. I got a bunch of them, obviously. We can't just write books, although that's important. I can't just give talks, although that's very nice. Thanks for coming. We do have to preach and walk people to the cross. I don't know any other way to do it. I really don't, right? So it's got to be in there, okay? And also, my last bullet point on that page 10, right, that there is a authentic cross and telling people the hard truth about things that they don't want to hear. That's the cross for the caregiver, okay? Because it'll be the case one day, I think, where some of these people who are going through this are going to come back to me and you and say to us, why didn't you love me enough to tell me the truth? I mean, why didn't anybody stop me and say, "You, this is not true. You all went along with this because you didn't want to make me feel bad, or you were afraid." I get that, but did anybody love me enough to tell me the truth and hold the line here? If you're a parent or a friend, it's an extremely hard thing to look at a person and say, "I don't accept this. It's not good for you," because you're so mortally afraid of making them upset. The only place a parent can take refuge when you have to tell your child what they don't want to hear is in the cross. There's no other place to do it. So the cross applies all around the situation, right? For those going through it and those having to walk people through it, because it's hard, okay? And there aren't any really good, perfect answers. And when one comes to a place where there's no perfect answers, one's come to Calvary. That's where we are on this topic. We're at Calvary. We have to see it for what it is, okay? And only God's going to get us out of it, right? Last couple pieces, really quick. Top of page 11. Is it a sin to experience sexual identity discordance? No, it is not. Often the interior psychological conflict that's going on over one's biological sex are rooted in these experiences that are hard, in confusion over expectations, about stereotypes, about things that happened when you were a kid, things among friends. I mean, all this mess goes into the stew of our psychosexual development, and most of it is not our fault at all, okay? It's just what happened to us as people, right? And I always say this. My operating definition of original sin, not a theological textbook one, but my operational definition of original sin goes like this. Wounded parents raise wounded kids who raise wounded kids who raise wounded kids who raise wounded kids who raise wounded kids. That's original sin. There are no exceptions to that at all, except the Blessed Mother and the Lord Jesus. Okay? And God had to intervene to stop that cycle in their case. That's what baptism is for. It intervenes from the outside to rescue us from above. That's the point. So, is it your fault if you're having a hard time accepting your identity? Probably not, okay, because it's just what you grew up in, right? Is it your parents' fault? Yes, blame them. Go to therapy and blame your parents. I tell parents, just get used to one day they're going to be in therapy talking about you. Just make peace. It's cool. Have it tell every parent, okay? We all try our best, right? It's just the way it goes. However, is it a sin to alter one's body as a result of the compulsions due to sexual identity discordance? Well, it can be, okay, because here we're talking about seriously harmful behaviors. Okay, mutilating one's body is a sin. Mucking with one's healthy systems with hormones and everything else, that is sinful behavior. But here's the thing, okay, if a person is under such compulsion about this, it probably diminishes the responsibility for it. That's called culpability. So, I mean, is the action wrong? Yes, it is. That's gravely immoral. Are you fully at fault for it? Maybe not. I mean, some people are under such internal pressure about this that they're not thinking straight. And when one's not thinking straight, then it becomes really hard to make them responsible for it. Okay, so mortal sin involves full responsibility. Are they fully responsible? In some cases, probably not. So better not to go there, okay? We can judge the actions, gravely wrong actions, but the condition of the heart, that's a much more difficult game to play. I leave that up to God. How about that, right? But the actions are the actions. Those we can see and we can judge those and we need to judge those things, okay? Further down though, you know, who else is part of the whole picture of what's sin responsibility? Well, the medical community, the counseling community, behavioral scientists, anybody who is not thinking this through clearly, right? Doing surgeries on otherwise healthy kids or adults and mutilating bodily systems that are working just fine, that's bad medicine. It's bad medicine, right? So one must think about that. Who's responsible here? Same thing for parents who never really asked priests for help or never kind of thought this through, right? I think most parents are panicking, so hard to place blame there too, but one must try and think clearly whenever possible. This is the goal, right? And same thing for legislatures, lawmakers. I mean, if you're driving an agenda on this topic, you've got a real part to play, and you're going to answer for that one day, okay? So one must hope that you are trying to be as helpful as possible and compassionate, even if you're mistaken about how to do it. At least then your motives are good. I can give you that much, okay? But all the ideology behind this right now in the legal world is scary, and it's very unfortunate, right? So that's enough, okay? There's a lot more, and I know I didn't cover everything. Last little piece of resources there, just so you can see them on the bottom of that page. There is only one church document that deals with this in the current explicit language and rhetoric of current gender ideology, and it's from the Congregation for Education from 2019. So it is not coming from a major congregation on doctrine, which it probably should have come out of. This is from the one that deals with schools. It came up there because that's how the Vatican decided to wade into it. It was coming up in educational settings, as it is right now in our own particular secular world. So if you read this, it's a good document, but it's not going to be a comprehensive treatment about it. Okay, that is yet to be produced. I'm not sure whether they're going to give us one, but for the moment, that's the best I can give you for a Vatican document on it. Otherwise, on the website, Society for Evidence-Based Gender Medicine, SEGM, great resource for good data. The Person and Identity Project, great resource for parents, educators, school counselors, whatnot, pastors, because that tries to help navigate the legal realities of this these days. Unfortunately, in many school districts now across the country, if you are an adolescent or younger, and you present to a teacher or a counselor in a school that you are having a gender question, unless the parent goes along with that, you're pretty much pushed out of the picture almost right away, and the school takes over, because they are of the opinion that a parent should never deny their child the right to change their gender. This is becoming enshrined in legal practice in lots of places. It's very, very difficult. So these websites kind of help figure out, what do you do? How do you get through this? How do you talk about it effectively? How do you figure it out? The Courage International website has recently updated the handbook for the chaplains. And there's a section toward the very end, it's only about 3 pages long, but it's good, on questions of sexual ID and gender discordance. And you can find this online. It's a quick little read. It's a nice little thumbnail of this. On the back table is the book by Ron Anderson, When Hair Became Sally, Respond to the Transgender Movement, Encounter Books 2018. You might recall that Amazon banned this back in the spring because they thought it was dangerous because it questioned the ideology of the moment. I think they may put it back on, I didn't check, but for a while you couldn't get it, so don't take that one. Hard to find that book, that's my book. And then also back there is Maria Keffler's book, Desist, Detrans, Detox, Getting Your Child of the Gender Cult. That one you can still order electronically or on Amazon, and you can see there's a sample copy back there. And then lastly, and shameless self-promotion, is my blog. If you're really bored and can't fall asleep at night, you can read my article, Transgenderism Has No Clothes, little piece on it, right? So there's more things out there. Bottom line, okay, it's a huge topic. I guess if nothing else, what I want you to walk away from today with is, you know, the fact that if it strikes you in your heart that there's something that's awry or amuck about all the gender language, then the answer is you're right. It is amuck. Okay, so don't buy it all completely because there are things seriously wrong with it. It is doing serious harm to people. However, we must at least acknowledge what's lurking underneath of it is the authentic search for acceptance and meaning in these people's lives. Their hearts are hurting, so one must know that. And it's a question of, there are better and worse ways to help that, okay? Unfortunately, a lot of what we're selling right now are the worst ways to help it. The more time-consuming, less popular pathway of good counseling and help is the better way to help it, and that's what we as a church want to advocate for as much as possible, for these people and for their families. So to do that, we got to know our facts, we got to know the arguments, we got to know what this means, and we have to be as patient and kind as possible without getting caught up in ideologies that are just not true. So maybe if nothing else, these are some building blocks today. Do a lot at you. You can keep the outline. This talk has been recorded and will be available to you for later on. So if that's a help, share it. That's great. Otherwise, thank you for your time. I will take questions when we're all over with. You come to see me personally. But thank you and have a good rest of your day. Thank you.